Hey, I'm Jake Brennan, and I want to tell you about Disgraceland, the award-winning music and true crime podcast that I host. Disgraceland tells the stories of musicians getting away with murder and behaving very badly. Fleetwood Mac, Nipsey Hussle, Cardi B, Ozzy Osbourne, Taylor Swift, Tupac, The Beatles, Amy Winehouse, Jay-Z, The Grateful Dead, and so many more. This is not the music history you've heard before. This is an uncensored, immersive look at the lives of musical icons as seen through the crimes they've committed or that have been perpetrated against them. Did Jerry Lee Lewis murder his fifth wife? What really happened to Sam Cooke in that seedy motel at 3 a.m.? And how did the Rolling Stones wind up sleeping with the First Lady? Wait, what? New episodes of Disgraceland drop every Tuesday with bonus episodes released on Mondays and Thursdays. So get in, buckle up, and join me in Disgraceland. Available right now, wherever you get your podcasts. Rock and roll.
We just wanted to be around, you know, anyone with a haircut. We didn't know possible divisions, so that helped us a little bit that we didn't, we want rockabilly versus punk versus mod versus suedo versus skin versus grebo versus new wave. We thought everyone with any haircut was cool.
Hi, this is Lowell Tolhurst, co-founder of The Cure.
And this is Budgie, co-founder of The Creatures, drummer with The Slits, and Susie and the Banshees.
Welcome to Curious Creatures.
Life after punk.
You may think you know the territory,
but we drew the map. Can I be the perfect host and welcome our guests to Curious Creatures this evening or this morning or this afternoon? This is Budgie in Berlin.
And me, Lowell Tolhurst in Los Angeles.
And we're speaking today with Jenny V and Slim Jim Phantom, who are in Dallas. I'm really quite excited because I'm sitting here, you know, and I've been thinking about talking to yourself, Jim, because I don't know if we've actually physically met somewhere in the our past, but I feel like I've known you for a long time because I can hear the music. And I've been back in London for the last 2 days in my mind. Mm. A place called The Venue in Victoria.
Mm-hmm.
Did you ever know? Ever get? And actually, the place was legends.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. We played there quite a few times. Richard Branson was the owner of the club.
Right.
That's right. Yes.
That was one of our big moments when all the Rolling Stones came to see us play there. They're all at a table. And it was maybe the last time they've all been together. It's
never happened since.
Yeah.
And I'm wearing the t-shirt if I'm not sure you're playing with them.
And we did the opening act, and they asked the headline act, whatever it was back then, some other pub band, to swap with us for the timing, and they said no. And all of these luminaries, including most luminescent, the all five Stones were at this gig at the venue, and as soon as we finished, they left.
Yeah.
So, band, if they had kind of changed their thing, they would have at least had the Rolling Stones sitting through. But the venue was a great, and you and I have met a few times. Once was at maybe even a few times at Keith Altham's office.
That's what I was going to say. That's the connection, isn't it?
Yeah, that was the one thing about Keith Altham's office, who was a big PR guy. And anytime you'd go there old school to do your interviews, you'd go to the office.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there was always someone there. Stuart Copeland is my buddy, who I've stayed in touch with all these years. We met him there. And there would always be someone in the office up there. There's been a kid walking in there, there would always be somebody in that office. Who are getting ready to do theirs or walking out or meeting or... And it was always, I remember meeting you and Susie there very early on.
Goodness.
We were sleeping on the floor in the back room, I think. And we were
the story you told me, Jim, about meeting the first time you met Keith Altham is a great story about, you know, how you just sort of turned up and said, well, we're the greatest band in the world and you need to, you know, do something with us. And
we were kicking around London. We were homeless, the whole thing. And we had heard, about an office that they represented the Stones, the Who, Police, Rod Stewart, like just every famous name you could imagine. This was the office. I didn't even know what PR was or public, but this address was where everyone was. You had to go there. So I heard it from someone at a party that we were at. And the next day I went by myself and knocked on the door. Oh. And they looked in. It was 56 Old Compton Street. I'll never forget.
Yes. Wow. That's a great memory.
The address is like brings it all back now. Yes.
Went up the stairs and I went in there and just said, we're the greatest band in the world. We're from New York. We have nowhere to live, but everyone will regret they don't take care of it. You know, I had were kind of flabbergasted and said, well, you know, where are the others? They're not here. What's your name of the band? We don't have one. Do you have a demo? No. And they said, come back tomorrow. Bring the other two with you. So I did. I went back to the same office, had the other two with me in tow, and they asked the same, do you guys have a demo tape? No. Do you guys have any gigs lined up? No. Do you know anyone in town? No. Nothing. They were so intrigued. They rented us a little rehearsal room somewhere in Soho, I think. Yeah. We all walked out there, and we did the whole gig in a tiny little padded rehearsal room that was the size of a – and we did the whole show. We stood on the drum. We argued with each other. We knocked into each other. We did the whole entire thing. And they said, this is the greatest thing ever. So they helped us. They called around that little pub circuit.
Right.
And we just played them. And they had a little bit of that machine behind them that they were the PR people. And we've been hanging around at the parties and, you know, squats and get any free nightclubs we could hang around in. And we saw you guys play. And we just – word of mouth, and then we were good at it, and it all spread, and that was very much how London was in 1980.
Yeah, I remember seeing you play.
They were intrigued by the story of us. These guys from New York, they have nowhere to live, they're playing here. Okay, so, and we just became fast friends with everyone.
But you saw the homeless boys playing.
They were called the Stray Cats by then, but they played at the Marquee. I saw you at the Marquee, and that must have been like 80, 81 maybe, I don't know. And the thing that struck me, because like, you know, I had rockabilly mates, right? So they told me, hey, you got to go and see these guys. So off. It wasn't that far to me as a sort of leap of, you know, thinking about things, it wasn't that far from punk at all. It was like the roots of all of that, like the energy coming off stage with you guys, you know. It was just like, I understood it immediately. I mean, I liked, you know, some earlier rockabilly stuff and things, but once I saw like this new version, you know, like regenerated, it was the magic was there. It's great.
That's really the thing we found in England that proved our manifesto, was that all roads lead to Eddie Cochran, and it didn't matter if it was punk or ska or any, we weren't very big on all that kind of dividing the genres. Everyone has to agree on Eddie Cochran.
For you, what made you come to England? Had you felt like, you know, fish out of water living in, you were in Long Island, right? In New York.
Yeah. On Long Island, we were tooled up 24/7. And we had got turned on to the music by kind of deep researching a little bit, the Beatles and the Stones and the Who and the Clapton, a song by Bee Holly. Well, who's that? And the movie came out, Buddy Holly story, American Graffiti a few years ago. It was just all becoming the right age to be able to make these kind of choices. And for me, I went into New York City one day, train shot straight to Penn Station. I got out, walked downtown to St. Mark's Place, cut over to Third Avenue, and with long hair, stopped at the Hair Power, which was a gum-chewing, wise-cracking new wave girl. Right? So I went on my hair, cut like Elvis Presley. She said, well, it's about time. I left the hair on the floor there, walked across the street to Trash and Vaudeville, got blue suede creepers, D-rings, walked down the street, got some baggy pants, Andy's Cheapies, further down the street, Cheap Jacks, got a black and white bowling shirt and a fleck jacket. And then I went home. Didn't expect anyone to notice.
No.
And Brian was having the same experience as me. He was a little bit ahead. He got his hair cut a week ago. And then he and I started a little bit, him and me playing a tiny drum kit. And then Lee was our other friend. We needed a bass. We wanted to be like Buddy Holly and the Crickets or the Blue Caps. And so that was the evolution of it. And a lot of it was coming from you guys in England. We were getting the NME 6 months late or whatever kind of thing at the newsstand or like a certain record store that would get it from a newsstand in England. And there was an article about rockabillys or Teddy Boys fighting with mods. And we just thought it was an incredible thing ever. And our goal was always to go and be around. We wanted to find a fourth person who had heard of Buddy Holly or Ursel Hickey or rockabilly a little bit deeper than just the oldie station. We went to England and we got off the plane and you said it was a good idea. No, you said it was a good idea.
Did you think Ringo was going to be waiting for you at the front of the airport to chauffeur you into London?
I did pretty much think that. Terry Thomas and Ringo were going to be there.
It's kind of in Britain. Those kind of things were happening with greater frequency, you know, skinhead, suede head, mod. The mods were kind of always coming back and the rockers were coming back. And around the time of punk, we had like our guys looking after if we had, you know, some gear to carry. There'd always be like a younger guy who was like had the quiff and the drain pipes and the brothel creepers. And they were always like the ones who wanted to carry the gear. I don't know what is going on, but it was a crazy time of everything mixed up.
And everything was something. That's what we loved about it. We just wanted to be around, you know, anyone with a haircut. We didn't know possible divisions. Helped us a little bit that we didn't, we weren't rockabilly versus punk versus mod versus suedo versus skin versus grebo versus new wave. We thought everyone with any haircut was cool.
Yeah.
Right.
We thought that was, without knowing it organically, because where we came from, no scene of any, there was CBGBs and Max's Kansas City, but it's a little bit, I think the legend is a little overblown. There wasn't that much going on, really. As you know, maybe a few people downtown, but it wasn't any, you know, tribe everywhere. Like
that's so nice to hear, you know, because I really could buy into the Deborah Harriam, you know, everybody was like all the clubs are right next to each other, and every night Talking Heads, Blondie, Ramones, Suicide, they were all like, oh,
the legend is always much more pervasive than the truth. You know, you're right though, Jim. There was like a lot of cross fertilization in London, because I can remember the first time we had enough money finally in the band to go out and get stage gear. You know, like we're gonna get some suits and stuff. And my mates, I was mates with the guys that run Robot. You remember Robot?
I remember those guys, yes. We went to all those places, and we thought it was so cool down there. There was the King of Wyoming that was next to Johnson's, an American Classic.
Yeah.
And you guys are a little bit older than me. Sex would have been there, but when we got there, it was already World's End.
Yeah.
Yes, right. World's End, I remember that one.
That area was where we gravitated to. And but we were still sleeping on the floor at Claudine Riley and Keith Altham's office. And then after the first couple of gigs, the people from ITM, Rod McSween and Barry Dickens, came to see us play. And then we were allowed to sleep on the floor of ITB.
Oh, you were. So we were
floor of 56 Old Compton Street. To the floor of 117, 119 Wardour Street.
Oh my goodness. Wow.
So you're moving up.
Yeah.
Moving up.
Right? I like this. Floors we have known.
My beautiful wife, Jenny V, she went to England as well, being like me, being gravitated to go what we thought was cool in England.
I did the exact same thing when I was the exact same age as you, 18, 19 years old, and that was it. I'm from Sudbury, Ontario, Canada, 4 hours north of Toronto. It's a mining town, Grim, And I thought, okay, I got to leave. I got to go somewhere. And Toronto was the obvious choice, but that was too obvious for me. And I wanted to go to where I thought that exactly I would get along with people, and all the music that I loved was birthed there. And so it was the same kind of a pilgrimage in a way for me as well. I didn't have like the most exciting, how do I follow up those stories? I really can't.
But you made a pilgrimage to London. Did you stay there?
No, I went back to Toronto. The hard thing there for me was that I couldn't find people who play in a band. I know that sounds crazy, but nobody had gear or the ability to get to rehearsal. It was like a bunch of non-committal people.
Right.
So I ended up doing everything myself. I played bass. I taught myself bass when I was a young teenager, and I then taught myself to play guitar when I lived there. I spent a lot of time alone. It was funny, you know, it was the opposite of you guys having these social connections. I went there and kind of just sat in my flat and was like, okay, I have to do everything myself. So I got a port a studio, and I taught myself to play guitar and programmed drums, and I made a demo tape, which I then
started
mailing out, pretending I had a band. I started getting replies, and people wanted to see the band play, but there was no band. So it was a good sign. And John Peel actually called my flat. And
wow.
This is
good
great.
Good old Peely.
Demo tape, yeah. This three-song demo tape that I had done. And so I took that all as good signs, and I went back to Canada and did go to Toronto, and with all that, you know, positive reinforcement that I was on the right track, was able to start a band with some people I had met in high school, like this amazing drummer, rest in peace, Robbie Campbell. He was like the metalhead in my town, and I was the only goth girl. So he and I kind of related, and I knew he was a really sick drummer. So he joined my first band, and we were able to get grants from the Canadian government so we could really record. And as much as I missed living in London, it was meant to be that I went home to start cultivating that. And I was still really like 20 years old at that time.
Wow.
That's a great story. I mean, what I get from that, I get 2 points from that one. Was one, you found the best thing you have to find for any band, the sick drummer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's no band without the drummer. We all know that, right? And the other thing is that, you know, London was really your 40 days in the desert. It's where you found you, right?
I wasn't really inspired by the scene that was going on at that time. That was more like mid-90s, 95.
Yeah.
The Britpop era and all those copycat bands that really weren't doing it for me. Like, no offense, Menswear or Travis or any of those bands, but it wasn't really my thing. So
right.
You wanted to go back to his first band and
yeah, I was like, where's that?
Yeah, by that time I'd left England by the middle of the 90s. I've lived out here longer than I've lived anywhere else in my life now.
We were from New York, went to England, lived there for a few years.
Yeah.
And but we had never traveled in America, even though I think we're the most American band ever.
Yeah.
We were lumped in a little bit with British New Wave. When MTV started, they had 8 videos that they would, and we had one, and they got hold of Stray Cat Strut. We were brought to the States to kind of play a showcase kind of thing, and we went to LA, play the Roxy, and I just never left.
It's funny, isn't it? That whole thing, we had exactly the same experience. When they first started, they were in that little place in Hell's Kitchen, like that, you know, like a tiny little room, basically. Mm-hmm. But you were right. They only had like 6 or 8 videos a week. So we made a video, and, you know, we were these strange guys with funny hair and makeup, and they had to put us on. Mm-hmm. They had to put us on. And that was totally the only reason we got on MTV, because they wouldn't have put us on otherwise if they'd had other videos. You know, but it was like so few things to play. They were like, okay, now we'll put the Cure on. And that changed everything for us. I remember coming to LA and we played somewhere, and suddenly, you know, gone were these very serious young men looking at us playing. It was like full of screaming girls. So it was kind of a good change, you know.
That's what I want to know, Budgie. When did you have time to practice the drums? Because you're the best of all. And when did you be that good? That's what I want to know.
It's funny. I suppose thinking back, it was in Liverpool, excuse me, Eric's Club in Liverpool. And if we did our kind of what's deemed to be the number of hours you put in.
10,000, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that would have been it. But as when I'd been in a band called Spitfire Boys. And we were given the keys to Eric's, really, to, you know, go in the night after the gig and set some gear up, and we could basically use the club to rehearse in. And, you know, it couldn't get any better. I didn't have a drum kit, so there was, I think the guy who cleaned the place had a drum kit, so he lent me his kit. So it was all borrowing, all favors. But that's where we put the time in. There was me, Holly Johnson was playing bass with Big in Japan, Ian Brody, Lightning Seeds guitar, Bill Drummond, later KLF, later manager of Echo and the Bunnymen and all that. David Balfe was also a member of that. And then, of course, Jane Casey, who was our front effigy, our singer. And it was all that, really. It was just, you know, we just turn up every day and just argued, you know. Like, you can't play. You can't play. No, you can't play. So you play this then. And so he's, okay, play that. And force each other. But after that, it was always you played when you were playing, and I never went home and rehearsed. I never practiced my rudiments. I don't know what rudiments are. I know what they are. But
you made your own, didn't you? Tell me you made your own rudiments.
The only ones I know for sure are the ones I taught myself.
Right. I know what your secret is, because you can sing all your beats, right? He sings all these beats. Like, he'd be just sitting in the corner, he starts singing drum beats to things, and they're always, I can pick out any song from what he's singing the beat, you know. Like, most people come up to you and go, boom, chip, boom, chip, 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 boom. And you go, and they go, what song's that? And they go, I have no bloody idea, but budget, I can tell every time.
Now I have to give away where it really started. Okay, so when I'm a kid on my own in the little terraced house in St. Helens outside Liverpool, my parents have gone out for the night on Saturday night. My brother's already out. My sister's probably gone out looking for Ringo's drumsticks somewhere. And I'm in there with a stereo. And when I went to sleep, I used to sing myself to sleep by singing Beatles albums or Cliff Richard and the Shadows. And I'd have to sing the instrumentals, and I had to sing the albums in sequence, because if I missed a track out, I'd have to go back, almost like lift the needle in my head and put it on again and go through the album. And I was learning albums of music to get me to sleep. My sister thought I was crazy. She was a bit scared, you know. Like, most people talk in their sleeps. You sing in yours. Do you think that's important, Jim? It's that knowing the song.
Yeah.
So many drummers think it's about, sitting in the back and keeping a beat. But it's like knowing the song inside out somehow.
I think Ringo, Sir Richard of Starkey, who's, of course we all love him the most. And I think that really the right approach was to get inside the song, and the drums go outward from that kind of, you make the song as good as you can by what your contribution to it can be.
Yeah, what your ability is. I mean, I was never, going to be, this superstar drummer, but I loved music and I loved the songs, and I knew what I could add to them. I knew what I could put in them. And so that's what I would do. And that's what I concentrate on. I mean, the thing I've found now is the older I've got, the more I love playing drums. Back in when I was like in my 20s, I loved playing them, but it was like a blood sport. It was like boxing. I was going to get damaged out there, after a couple of hours. And there was, we know the blood on the snare, sticks in the eyes, all kinds of things and that. But now it's much more like, I wouldn't say, it's like, I've become like an old jazz guy, but I love just like the mantra of the drums sitting behind it and just getting right inside that rhythm. I saw you play at the Greek a couple of years ago now. Right. And I was watching you and I was thinking, wow, that's exactly what Jim's getting out of it. It's like, it's just the pure joy of it. And I was standing in a little place at the front, and Tony Cannell from No Doubt was standing behind me. And I know Tony, different things. And I turned around and he had the same big smile on his face that I did, you know, and that to me, that said everything about, you know, what it is to just be up there and playing the music, playing the drums. You know, it's really all the drummers that I admire, and I include both of the drummers that are here right now, they inhabit the music. They're not just, you know, they're not timekeepers. They inhabit the music, and without them, the music's not there. And that's my rant for today, for this session.
I just want to say how emotional I feel.
I feel emotional too.
Yes.
But it's so true. And that I can relate to that as a bass player, because when I was talking about writing my own songs and doing my own thing, that was a whole other experience. But now that I play in other people's bands and I play their songs, I can truly just not even focus, just have a rest, just go up there and enjoy my playing. And
right.
the word joy, all that you said, it's like embodying the music and not having any like emotional turmoil or ego or anything about the song that I may have wrote at a time in my life, like just going out there just to rock.
Right.
And just be in that moment is the best feeling in the world. And yeah, as I'm getting older, I agree with you completely. You just have a connection with it that, I don't know, you can't describe it unless, I guess, you know, as a musician.
Yeah. So, that same night that you were talking about, that we at the Greek, that was one of our most magical nights. That was because the special guests on the Cats show was Eagles of Death Metal. Jenny's gang played
as
guests that night. And it was all of our pals, you, Tony, it was so many of our super pals were there. Yeah. I had the extra, you know, drummer world of, right, no one else could see it because it was right behind the curtain, exactly where it stops, with Stuart Copeland standing 18 inches away from me the whole time. And I'm like trying to, with a smile on his face. And like, I have to be careful, because once in a while, we all know this as drummers, you do something pretty good and then you feel it a little too tasty. And Stuart Copeland's ass. In my head, I'm fighting, like, not trying something really crazy that you may or may not pull off.
Right.
So I just let – that's when your years of kind of training, like, don't do it. Don't listen to that voice. Play the song. Don't try to do some lick from Roxanne right now just to show that's when it takes over.
Yeah.
The joy of being in the moment, right, and not letting anything creep in there.
Hey, we have a congratulations, Jenny V and Slim Jim. You were married last year, right?
Yes, we were.
Yeah.
Kind of like a Zoom thing, yes, with a judge. Yeah. And it's like, okay, you're married now.
Yeah.
We had a slightly grander plan that was supposed to involve going to the courthouse in Beverly Hills. That's part.
Yeah.
Part was all a good plan. And then that evening, it didn't get past the planning stages into hour before calling everyone we know part. Everyone was going to come to play the Roxy.
Wow.
Have our party and then get remarried again by Jesse Hughes in his reverend collar after it was legal by the judge in Beverly Hills.
Right.
And we planned to call everyone. We have the Stray Cats, Lyle, you're going to have to play. Budgie, you're going to have to come out. But everyone had to come. It was going to be, we would start at 4 p.m. and until they close the doors. Everyone has to come and do their bit. But the world's illness came and things got changed and we didn't make all the calls. So you're still going to get that call.
Oh.
the call that we did get 3-4 months later was in a number I didn't recognize, and it was the county clerk's office of Los Angeles County.
Uh-oh.
And saying, your license is going to expire. You have to do this now. And now we're honoring these licenses. Do you want to get married? So I'm still want to get married. So I yell on the phone. Do we still want to get married? Yes. Okay. Tomorrow, 9 a.m., we got my son and Jenny's friend Netta to be our witnesses. And we propped up the Zoom like this the next morning. And it was us on one end. And just like you guys, there was a county clerk and a judge. Took maybe 3 minutes.
That's a wonderful story.
And we're, you know, we've yet to pull the trigger on the big charity show, though. That's we're gonna that's gonna be when the dust is a little bit more settled. There'll be two drum kits, four guitars, everyone's gotta play from Stray Cats down to The Cure. Everyone's in between, everyone's gotta turn up and play.
You make such a beautiful couple. Beautiful couple.
Exactly. You know, it's funny because that's the best kind of marriage, I think, because like I got married to Cindy. We just did it like on a whim. We went out to Vegas, you know, we got married in this chapel. My friend came in, was from England, and I said, you know, we're just going out to Vegas. You're going to be my best man. Off we go. And, you know, my first wedding was like, you know, this huge extravaganza, and that didn't last that long. And this one's lasted, you know, a very considerable time now. And I always think it's because we got married in Vegas. It was really funny. One of the Smothers brothers was behind us getting married at the same time. So it was like...
I'm your dick. Which one?
Gosh, you know, you've got me there. The one that's been married a lot.
The crew cut or the more suave one?
No, the crew cut one. The crew cut one, right.
Okay. If we're on wedding stories, okay. Yeah. My mine was 11 years ago and took place in Hong Kong.
Wow.
Which is where my wife was born in Hong Kong from English parents, we should say, because Hong Kong was still the British territory out there. Yeah. But I was on tour with, let's see, in 2010 with a band from Brighton, and we were in Japan. So I managed to wangle a ticket to go back to England or back to Berlin via Hong Kong so I could meet my future father-in-law and do the right thing and ask for his daughter's hand in marriage.
Wow, and dedication.
I had only been to Hong Kong once before in 1982, I believe it was, and it was a very different place. But I was so nervous, you know, going out on the ferry to this little island and wondering how I'd be greeted. And anyway, I had to get there because it was in Hong Kong. It's going to be difficult getting people over there, you know. So right. we got married at now what's it called? A cherry Cotton Tree Drive registry office in Hong Kong. It's just like so romantic little name.
Sounds very romantic.
It was. And it's a funny place. I've kind of managed to get back there on occasion as well, you know.
You got some frequent action happening on this one, man. This is Hong Kong to Brighton to Japan to... You're going to get upgraded.
Yeah. there's a song in there somewhere, isn't there? There's a song, you know, from Brighton to Hong Kong to... Yeah, there's a song there.
I think we have to put it right here. Everyone's going to come back with a verse by the next interview. Now, do you remember Carlton's office when we met now that you reckon you
brought I remember Claudine like it was yesterday and Michael being around. I can't picture have Keith's face there yet, but I remember Compton Street. It's strange how some things are really clear and other things are kind of can't, you know, as if there's a blank spot.
Well, it's one thing that happened there was a life-changing event. How the little precursor of that was we were in a pub just wandering around in Soho, and Ronnie Lane, if you remember Ronnie Lane, right. The Small Faces and The Faces and was walking out of a pub, and he had that 70s kind of like teddy boy thing. He had a drape coat on, short drain pipes, big white creepers, but he was like mod. He had the mixed things going on. Paisley. And he literally bumped into us, and we were all kind of tooled up but disheveled at the same time, wandering around. And he said, "Who are you guys?" And we told him the same story. We're from New York. Nobody knows us. He said, "Come with me." 1 minute later, and we got into a black taxi with him, and he took us to Twickenham, where he lived, in some ramshackly Spinal Tap mansion with chickens and dogs, gravel driveway, kids running around. And he announced to his wife, "Katie, we have guests." And we stayed in his house for about 2 weeks. And while we got our whole world together and arranged those, gave Keith Olfin the time to find the gigs.
And that, ladies and gentlemen, is the healing power of music right there, right?
Yeah. I can follow that story up with only a mild story, because we were at a pub in Covent Garden one night with Spitfire Boys, and we walked in this place, and I think the bass player and a couple of mates from Sweet were at the bar.
Okay. Yeah.
And we all kind of couldn't help ourselves, but just went, we just haven't got a clue what to do. And I think we then had to run out the pub because he was about to nail us, you know, he's about to because he wasn't wasn't most pleased.
Right. Some guys are tougher than they looked.
There you go. There you go.
What gets me, he said, well, this is a lovely conversation. It's so lovely touching base. Yeah. As I say, it felt like we've always known each other. And Jenny, it's so lovely to meet you. It's all very emotional stuff for me, this. It's very beautiful.
Thank you so much for taking your time out and talking to us. We owe you one, and Jenny as well.
We'll see you soon, Paul. Yep. Budgie, I just think I'm a super fan of your drumming, and, you know,
I'm still singing the songs, Jim.
Yep.
Jenny, it's been a pleasure.
What a pleasure.
Look forward to seeing you, both of you, very soon.
See you, kids.
Bye.
Bye.
Now, Peter, our friend Peter from Berlin, has a question for us.
Okay.
Which is a very interesting question. How is it to watch your own cover band? Does it make you proud, or is it more like, pardon my French, drinking your own urine?
So, oh, my. I've only had two occasions where I've never seen a Susan the Banshees cover band.
Yeah.
But I think it was Cleopatra Records, based out of
in LA.
They put together some bands that chose to cover Susan the Banshees songs.
Yeah.
And the funniest thing was hearing the approximation of like Susie's constantly changing London pronunciation.
Right.
And the way she just pronounces words. And of course, it was a bit like listening to old cartoons of the Beatles when they got regional accents all wrong. It's as close as you get. It's like me trying to put an American accent on, and I'm probably somewhere south of Brooklyn, north of Los Angeles, you know.
Right. North of Los Angeles, from west of Atlanta.
Could be anywhere in a 5,000-kilometer radius, you know.
Right.
So it was a little painful. But go on. Have you seen any Cure?
Have I seen any Cure cover bands? I have seen.
I think you know them. You've met them.
I do know them, and I have two thought processes on this one. But not thought process. I have two thoughts on this.
Hmm.
In Los Angeles, where I live, I have made friends with the best Cure tribute band, and they're called The Curse. And Brian, who is the singer and guitarist, he does not look like Robert, but he's very, very close in sound and technique and everything. And he's a very nice man, and his band is very good. And a couple of times, once to celebrate, they've been going for like 16 years, you know, they've been doing it for a long time. And they asked me to come and play with them when they played some a show, like a commemorative show for their 16 years, and it was a lot of fun, and it was great. And if I closed my eyes, you know, it was very, very, very close. And then they returned a favor for me, because I asked them, you know, we did a gig for a charity, so I said, you know, I need to have a band. So they came along and played, and that was very good, you know, and I'm sort of humbled and flattered at the same time. That's the way I think about them, you know. I have seen a couple of tribute bands that were less than stellar. Then I had I recently did a book tour just before the pandemic down in South America, in Peru and Chile and Argentina. And part of the thing for me going down there was, well, I'll talk about the book and that, but you know what? I could, you know, make more of the situation. I could play somewhere.
Right.
So I was kind of like Chuck Berry, you know, I did this sort of thing where, you know, we put out feelers to get people, you know, that played in Cure tribute bands in those areas, like in, you know, Arequipa in Peru and in Chile in Santiago and in Buenos Aires in Argentina. And so we would get these Cure cover bands, and I would never play with them. I would see their YouTube video and decide which one I thought was the best and pick them. And then I would send them a list of six songs or five songs, say, please learn these and I'll play drums with you on them. And then I would just turn up on the day, probably not even sound check, maybe a minute or two before the show. And we'd just sit there and we'd go, okay, we're going to do this one, that one, this one, this one. And I'd play. And it was okay as long as we stuck to the same arrangement. Sometimes they had, for some reason, they changed the arrangement a little bit and extended it. So, you know, I'd be sitting at the back shouting out, you know, four bars changes, you know, something like this. And they were all great. And what was really great always was the bass player. The bass player was always excellent in any of these bands. The thing where it was a little difficult, and it wasn't, it's absolutely, absolutely not their fault. They're all great musicians that I played with, and they were all really sincere and very nice people. But because, you know, I'm playing South America and it's their second language, you know, they're singing in English, it's their second language, and I play against the vocals. I'm not counting bars and beats generally, you know, except when I am, but listen to the singer.
So you're listening to them, yeah, the weight.
Yeah. Yeah. The way of the vocal, the way the vocal's going, how it's going, and I'm playing to that. So when English is your second language, sometimes some of it's lost in translation a little bit, and they were singing something, and I was thinking to myself, that's probably how it sounds, but that's definitely not the word that Robert sang.
Can you remember any of the words?
Yeah, no, I don't. I mean, my Spanish is awful, so I cannot, you know, I'm not going to be here and criticize anybody.
But
it was different. It was different. So, you know, to Peter's question is generally I've had good experiences with that. And, you know, I'm not going to join one anytime soon, but from time to time, it's kind of fun to play with them and, you know, enjoy that part of it.
Okay. Well, the second part, the answer I could give is I had an interesting experience in Berlin. Old friend of mine, dear friend, is no longer with us. It's Bill Rieflin. He was playing with REM.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And they came through. They were recording probably one of their last albums. And it was the most surreal situation. So I had, I was visiting Bill, and they were off to their gig. So we're all congregating in the grand foyer of the Hyatt Hotel on Potsdamer, which is not far from the old Hansatone studios where they were recording and where Susan the Banshees did some recording when the wall was still up. It's a long, circuitous story. Also in the same hotel were Pearl Jam.
Wow.
So I had Eddie Vedder sitting on one side, Mike Mills sitting on the other side of me. And Mike Mills proceeded to tell me that every year on Halloween, he puts together a Susan the Banshees tribute band. I say, you're having me on, aren't you, Mike Mills? You're just winding me up. And no, he wasn't. He said, you should check it out. And he showed me this little recording. And it was like really faithful rendition and great vocalist. I don't know if he's still doing it, but you know, not only was I sitting with the voice that makes the hairs on the back of your neck stand on end when you hear it live, Eddie's voice and Mike and I don't think Michael Stipe was around. He lives also. He has a place in Berlin, I think. It was just one of those surreal moments where you just find yourself surrounded by characters from other bands, and they're all kind of talking to you rather than the focus being the other way. Because I was,
amazes me is that they have time in their life and in their head to do a band other than themselves. You know, that's what I would find strange.
Well, I don't think at that point there that REM were at their busiest. I think things were winding down, I think. But, so perhaps Halloween is not their busy night. Whereas with the Banshees would always
it's probably
be
a busy
Halloween.
Night. Yes.
Curious Creatures is created and presented by Lol Tolhurst and Budgie.
Producer, Joe Wong.
Producer and audio designer, Dan Didier.
Executive producer, Mark Cates.
Associate producer, Sophie Wild.
Digital marketing, Margie Taylor.
Art and logo design, Justin Thomas Kay.
Music production, Jackknife Lee.
Curious Creatures is on the web, and you can access us at www.curiouscreaturespodcast.com.
And you can reach us on Instagram and Facebook at Curious Creatures Official, Twitter at Cure Creatures.
To find more of the best music podcasts, visit doubleelvis.com or follow at doubleelvis on Instagram or at doubleelvis on Twitter.
Curious Creatures is a production of LXB LLC 2022.